You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahia hi mari e tēnā koutou katoa, ko me e tōku ingoa.
Ko Sophia tōku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. Kia ora mea, how are you this week?
Hi, I'm good. How are you? I missed you.
I missed you too. I was in Sydney last week, yeah. But I'm so bad.
Did you have a good time?
I had an awesome time. Yeah. Such a great trip.
Yeah, I've really been manning the ship, holding the fort down.
You really have. I've been so often away this month.
Yeah, I've been so brave. So lovely to have you back sitting next to me in the stew.
Thanks for being brave.
Thank you. Welcome.
What have we got on the show today, Maya?
Yeah, I caught up with Brianna Jameson about her current exhibition on at Sanderson Contemporary Garden Day. So what have you got?
I caught up with artist Sky Lunson's story about her solo exhibition Te Mauri o Te Wai on at Window Gallery.
He aha o whakara, we'd love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tuku pitahi mai, you can text us on 5395. Toru Iwarima, or why my rane? Give us a call in the studio on 309-3879.
Also, after the show, koa e wareware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō hei pakihere rokiroki maronga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
What's it all for?
Various Artists.
Sky Lunson's story is a Tāmaki-based artist whose practice explores climate change, urban infrastructure, site-responsive approaches, and Indigenous futurisms through various mediums, primarily working across moving image, sound, and sculpture to dissect her subject matter. Her current solo exhibition at Window Gallery, Te Mauri o Te Wai, takes its name after Auckland Council's freshwater vision to protect and enhance the life-sustaining capacity of water, responding to the 2023 Auckland Anniversary Day floods and the ongoing failures of our urban water infrastructures through the sculptural installation. In Te Mauri o Te Wai, concrete, steel, wool, rainwater and harakeke act as vessels to resound the loss of wetlands in Aotearoa, holding great memory, Māori and agency as materials. Here the artist asks how we might shift from containing water to living with it, imagining a future where natural materials and infrastructures are treated as a healing aid and collaborator in our relationship with water. I had a kōrero with Sky Lunson's story about the show.
Kia ora, ko Sky tōku ingoa, ko Ngāti Maniapoto, ko te whakatohia, ko Ngāti Tūwhariatoa uku iwi. My practice is primarily sculptural and moving image based, and the key things that influence my work is looking into climate change, site-based practice and sound.
And your current exhibition at Window Gallery Te Mauri o Te Wai, you're responding to the ongoing impact of the 2023 Auckland Anniversary Day floods, as well as these faults within our urban water infrastructures, creating a sculptural installation in which a path of harakeke bushes lead to a rainwater fountain encompassed by a curtain of harakeke threaded with wool and held by this steel structure. I guess to introduce the show, would you like to start by speaking to the initial conception of this work and your interest in the subject matter?
I've been working in the realms of looking at the failure of urban water infrastructure for the past 3 years. I think starting from the year 2023, when those Auckland anniversary floods happened, I think my sort of initial interest in that stemmed from just having someone very close to me have their home like become displaced from the floods. Mm. And then I think from there that sort of confirmed to me how important our drainage infrastructure is and how important plumbing is and how it's deeply neglected, I think, at the moment. So from that, my first work that I did back in 2023 was called Flowing Waters, and that was a sculptural based work that took different various pipes, as well as I did a lot of plaster moulding as well. And so that was directly looking at the fact that our drainage infrastructure in Auckland is decades behind and needs to be re-looked at, and what are we going to do with that in a changing climate, essentially. And so progressing from there, then I did a sort of response to that work called Flowing Waters 2, but this piece was a moving image work that also used projection mapping. And so it was a sort of moving image work that was just taken of different recordings of the waterways around Auckland. And so it was basically looking at how when we have heavy stormwater, the sewage pipes and the stormwater pipes combine. And so as a result of that, our waterways are contaminated and we cannot use them anymore. And so I think that sort of set me on a path of looking into these sort of like civil spaces. Mm. And then 2024, I got a job as a university note taker through the Disability Services. And so through that, I was given a student who was in an architecture class. Mm. And so those were basically the key questions that they were asking and looking at, well, how can we create a sustainable relationship with land when that land has been contaminated and its roots are in something so like toxic and unhealthy, especially due to colonization. Then I was also given an engineering student, and then from then I was also, last year I was given a biodiversity student. And so those sort of the takeaways that I got from those subjects is what I ended up putting into my work and the development. And so by the time it got to 2025, I started becoming really interested in what was going to happen with the flood-affected areas. So I was doing research into the Category 3 sites and just what the council was sort of doing to future-proof our city. And so I started deep diving into these sort of council buyouts of land. So Category 3 is looking at sites that are intolerable to life. And so basically those homes were being bought by the council. I guess my pressing question was, what happens with land that is made uninhabitable by climate change? Mm. And so the answer to that is that the council actually don't know. Mm. And I saw that they've got a submissions page where if there's a site that you know of and you're interested and you have an idea of what you want to do with that land, you can propose that idea. But yeah, so I think my biggest fear when learning about this is just the possibility of redevelopment by private buyers, which has already happened. Mm. And so I was doing more research into these areas and I made a moving image work called Kei Tiheke Ngā Roimata o Ranginui, which basically means the tears of Ranginui are falling and is said when it is raining. And so that work was based in a Category 3 site where several homes had been removed, so it was just an empty plot of land. And this was located in Grey Lynn at the bottom of Dryden Street. Mm. And so I was sort of mapping the area out in the moving image work, and then also just questioning, well, recognising the past history of the site and then to who the whenua belongs to, as well as what the present looks like, and then questioning, well, what is the future for these places? And one big thing that felt really eerie to me was just all these houses are removed. You could tell that the site was initially a floodplain and wasn't meant to be built on anyway because of how muddy the ground was. Mm. But also, yeah, what got me was just the slabs of concrete that were left behind that basically were the driveways that now lead to nowhere. Mm. And so it was a very sort of, yeah, eerie feeling just like looking at something that is no longer there but has that lasting, I guess, like trace of it. And so that led into Te Mauri o Te Wai. Because I was doing so much research into Auckland Council, the title actually came from Auckland Council's future vision, which is to enhance and protect Te Mauri o Te Wai, the life-sustaining capacity of water. And so I sort of wanted to do a sculptural response to what I was feeling when making that moving image work. And so with that, my whakaaro on that is that these sites should be returned to the whenua and be made into wetlands as a way to help the drainage infrastructure that is failing anyway, but also, yeah, to just give a way to return the whenua to Papatua Nuku.
I want to get into speaking a little bit more to your materiality, more specifically shortly, but I guess before that, I'd love to hear a little more on how you took those initial concepts from ideas to making the work. As you said, you've worked in moving image and sound as well, but what led you to explore these ideas through sculpture specifically? Are you able to speak to this development of ideas and their final sculptural form?
I think I love using my hands basically. I'm a very tactile person.
Mm.
And I think with my moving image work, it was speaking to these sort of urban environments, but also speaking to our wetlands, which 90% have been destroyed.
Mm.
And so there's a sort of like yearning to bring those back, I guess. And so I was thinking, well, how can I make something that speaks to the materials of these two environments? So I think to represent each space, I sort of chose for the civil side, I chose concrete, because that is, yeah, there's lots of consequences when it comes to concrete with using it, which I'll get into later. And then harakeke as the other side. It was more so about me understanding these materials and how they work. I really wanted to sort of like get intimate with the materials. I've always loved working with harakeke because of the process, and then also the matauranga that comes from that. And I'm really appreciative of my tupuna and the fact that I can partake in raranga and just those like processes of harvesting. But when looking at concrete, I'm very familiar with working with materials like clay, which is very like moldable. But working with something like concrete was really quite new to me and a bit frustrating.
Mm.
I think I wanted the materials to speak for themselves in this work. And so the most important part of my process was getting to understand how they work. And what I really enjoyed also was just looking at the slight differences, and so like in how concrete dries in comparison to how harakeke dries.
Mm.
And also just showing about how these two different environments have two different outcomes. So with concrete, that's something that's not going to go away, whereas harakeke is part of an ecosystem that will give back to itself and regenerate and create more life. And so I really wanted to add the aspect of human touch into the work, especially when it came to concrete, because we're the ones who build our cities. And I feel like we're not really looking to the future of how to, I guess, protect ourselves and prepare for climate change.
Mm.
I feel silly saying that because it's just so talked about, but it quite literally is just that, the consequences of climate change and just the fact that the way that we've built our cities isn't sustainable and it's not going to last unless we change.
Yeah, I think it's interesting in terms of materiality. I kind of read that concrete and steel, I kind of read them as kind of these more hard materials,
yeah,
where you kind of see this in urban infrastructure as well, where the contrast between nature, greenery, natural material, and these big concrete buildings can be quite harsh,
yeah,
when nature is disrupted by the structure of our cities. And it feels like maybe in Te Moriori Te Wai, you've kind of explored in your placement of the harakeke bushes on the floor of the gallery and the fountain being this pillar of sorts, that maybe there's potentially an exploration of power shared unequally between these materials and the work. Does that sentiment resonate at all? Can you speak to me a little bit more about your process in terms of placement and installation there?
Mm. The power dynamic is really interesting, because immediately I think about the fact that there is an obvious power dynamic, just the fact that our wetlands have been taken away from us, and well, they became dumping grounds after the 1856 Wastelands Act. I did a lot of research before I made my work into Britt Graham's Wastelands work, because it's directly speaking to that, and then it's also speaking to the Māori economy, and by taking away these wetlands, they're also taking away the Māori economy that used to exist there. But I think I wanted to install it in a way, the rocks on the ground, if you look at them really carefully, they're all different handprints and like hand gestures,
yeah,
that I've done. And so I think I was thinking a lot about the, well, our footprint that we have as humans. And then for my sculptural work, there was a core that works, that is there purposely for the fountain. But rather than hiding that, I wanted to incorporate it into the work and make it part of it. So I'm speaking about these industrial spaces, so it made sense to me to get to use a bright yellow industrial cord. And when installing, I was wanting it to sort of be the trace of water. And so I think the whole work is like an intersection of just these two natural but also unnatural spaces combined, and seeing them, I guess, that contrast, that harsh contrast, to make you think about the way that we build our cities and the way that we can shift that also, and what we need to move towards. And so I also think with using the trace, with the little, the way that I've arranged the stones, I was thinking of them as little wetlands, because especially in Tamaki, we would have been covered in wetlands, this whenua. And so I guess that's where that sort of thought process came from. What is interesting, though, also is that I wanted more harakeke because I wanted to feel more balanced rather than there being a power imbalance a little bit.
Mm.
But I got my period and I wasn't able to harvest anymore when I needed to. And so that
blocked.
Sort of, so that also like changed it. But I guess that fed into part of the work as well.
Mm.
I think with the sculpture itself, I wanted to make sure that it had all the key elements that I was speaking to. And so I guess including water in that was quite difficult when I was trying to, I guess, plan out how was I going to create this installation, or well, this piece that I wanted. It initially started with the iron, with the steel rod frame, and the harakeke that I had sort of like wrapped around like a korowai around the piece. And then when looking at it, by elevating it, it gave it more of an architectural feel to it, I guess, and spoke more to the sort of kaupapa that I was looking in. And so that's where the idea of bringing water and bringing concrete into that sort of came to be. Because I was thinking, I initially used steel rather than concrete because I was thinking about the skeleton that is within our concrete and between our structures and our footpaths. That's what I was initially thinking of. But then it ended up coming into one and I was quite happy with. I feel like I should say something better than I'm happy. But it felt right, basically, bringing those in together.
What kind of underlies this work is this idea that materiality, memory, mori, and agency are intertwined, that material holds the weight of experience and can echo the impact and memories of the Auckland anniversary floods. Would you like to speak a little further to this idea and how these connections are revealed in the work as well?
To me, everything has whakapapa, everything has mori. Even when working with concrete, that sort of relationship between materials felt quite significant because you're working with limestone, which is basically shells of an ancient ocean, and then you're working with sand. And these materials as well, I just want to say concrete, we're kind of running out of concrete, which is crazy to me because of how extractive the sort of process of harvesting that sand and because it's riverbed sand. And so those processes themselves have heavy consequences. And through making this work, because I was mixing this cement and the sand to sort of get the right consistency that I could mold it with my hands and it wouldn't break when I put it down.
Mm.
And the amount of sand that went into that one sculpture was a lot more than I had anticipated. And it really, I think, it blew my perspective as to when looking around, I guess, our cities, when looking around the building that I was working in as well, because I was still at uni when doing that. And just that, yeah, it makes sense. Well, it's just like mind-blowing to me, I guess.
No, that's insane.
And so everything has memory. Everything has mori. I think that's something that I've always known and like stuck with and has stuck with me when looking at these places, like where did they come from, is quite important too, and just honouring that memory that these materials hold. And then also because when you're working with whenua, that whenua has a memory as well as what was the past, what used to exist there, what was the present, and looking at, well, what is the future of it going to be? As I said before, I think working, when I was doing that moving image work in the site is what, that's really what stuck with me when making it, because I was thinking about, well, how can I make a work that honours the past history of the site but also is empathetic to those who lived there and have been displaced from their homes and had to move and leave that behind. And so also when looking at the future of the site, you want to honour those that came before and like had connections with that site, rather than just building a whole new block of houses that could potentially flood and put people's life in jeopardy again.
That leads really nicely to my last question. You mentioned, of course, at the beginning that the work is titled after Auckland Council's freshwater vision, Te Mori o Te Wai, and it seeks to kind of resound the loss of the wetlands in Aotearoa and imagine a future where matter and natural materials and infrastructures are treated as a healing aid and a collaborator in our relationship with water, questioning how we might shift from containing water to living with it, using ideas of new materialism and Indigenous futurism to guide us. I guess just to kind of wrap up our corridor on the show, are you able to speak a little bit more to this exploration of future thinking and how it's explored in the work?
I think a lot of this work has been like quite literal research. I guess I could have been thinking more about the sort of sculptural terms and ways of using that, but I really wanted to let the materials guide the piece. And so a lot of my research was done into looking at the mahi of Troy Brockbank, civil engineer and storm and water practitioner, especially his research paper called Just Add Māori. And so basically he's looking at the combination of water-sensitive design with tikanga Māori. And he speaks about wetlands in particular in this paper and how they can be used as green infrastructure. He uses the Māori model, and it looks at how we can, by recognising that everything has Māori, we can use that to make better informed decisions and how we navigate water-sensitive design. And he talks about wetlands as an alternative of green infrastructure, especially because it costs so much to replace our pipes. Which needs to be done, and slowly, I think, is being done. But by having, well, one, I'm always in support of reclaiming and returning wetlands to the whenua, but also looking at it from a sort of, like, urban infrastructure, like, civil engineering point of view. The combination of stormwater infrastructure and green infrastructure, like wetlands, is a good way to sort of... It won't fix the problem that the floods create, but it will help reduce the impact of that. Wetlands are able to basically absorb water and hold water, which prevents the amount of rainfall that goes into our stormwater drains, so basically reducing the amount of flooding that we have. And it's, although still expensive, it's a good alternative, and they can work together. I think we should be bringing more sort of green infrastructure into our design of our cities as well, because it brings more biodiversity, as well as it enhances the life quality of those who live there. I think ultimately I would love to return all these sites to wetlands. That would be the ultimate, but I'm also aware of just the fact that that probably won't happen. So I guess in a way I'm like looking at alternatives of trying to create a kōrero and a conversation around, well, I guess the intersection of like bringing those two together.
That was artist Sky Lunson's story speaking to me about her current solo exhibition, Te Māori o Te Wai. The show is on now until the 18th of March at Window Gallery in the University of Auckland General Library foyer, so go check it out.
Yes, darling, but is it art?
You are listening to various artists here on 95BFM. This is a new track from Derry. This one's called Elfie. We'll be right back.
Bye. Hello, my little sparrows. If you're listening right now, then this message was meant for you. Claim it if it resonates. I've got my tarot deck here. I'm going to pull a card to illuminate an intention for you. Just shuffling. Ooh, it's the B card. This card represents prosperity, greatness, clout. Oh, I love this for you. Expect an abundance of free things. Music, merch, coffee, ticket.
Get a B card today from 95BFM.com for just $4.20 a month and be in to win tickets, albums, and more.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out! He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
The original originator. 95BFM. Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device. Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
Various artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
Brianna Jameson is a Te Whanganui Atara-based painter who produces luminous oil paintings through her expanded meditative painting practice, leaning into her love of writing and poetry, allowing the words to call out to her paintings and in turn the paintings to her poetry. In her current exhibition at Sanderson Contemporary Garden Day, Jameson produces a beautiful body of paintings that are inspired by her time spent at her local community garden, planting patches of flowers that she tends to and shares with her local community. This love of gardening cross-pollinating into her painting practice, with Jameson producing these glowing, dreamlike oil paintings of flowers and butterflies, a symbiosis of gardening and painting that pulls viewers into this warm embrace of nature and its tranquility. I had a chat with Brianna about the show and her overall practice.
My name is Brianna Jameson. I'm a painter. I live in Te Whanganui Atara, Wellington. I make oil paintings of all sorts of different sizes that are kind of soft and like one colour palette per painting, like all browns or blues, of things that make me feel good, a lot of plants and flowers. And yeah, I've been painting out of my studio. I've got a studio in the city on Courtney Place for the last few years since studying at art school in Wellington. Yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Yeah, wonderful. And your current exhibition on at Sanderson Contemporary Garden Day presents a beautiful series of paintings that were inspired by your days at your local community garden. I wanted to start this conversation to speaking to kind of, yeah, the footing of this exhibition. Where did this series first start to find its momentum?
So I think probably starting to grow flowers at this community garden. I got a plot just over a year ago, and it was so special. It, like, being surrounded by so many other gardeners and people growing things, and each time I'd go up to the garden, there'd be new plants and new flowers growing, and it was always this, like, special surprise. And I was, it's just the feeling of being up there felt so warm and glowy and refreshing and good, and I really wanted to make paintings that captured that feeling. So I think it started from that, and then I would have done some writing about kind of my time up there, and it often starts with like writing a little piece and then picturing what I'd like my paintings to look like, and gathering together photos and things of reference images, and yeah, it all kind of grew from there.
Great. And I think, yeah, gardening and painting have this wonderful symbiosis between them, this idea of like laying the groundwork and then building up from there. I find it so funny. I found in my time interviewing artists that painters keep on circling back to this metaphor of gardening, speaking to their paintings as if they were gardens that like they're being like tended to. I wanted to ask you about your personal connection between painting and gardening, and yeah, how do you find that they intertwine for you?
Yeah, it was almost this show where I really noticed how similar my style of painting was to my style of gardening, which was quite fun to fully discover. And with this community garden plot where I could fully, like, I had this big space to myself to like experiment and grow different plants and see how I enjoyed growing things. And yeah, I got this like really good sense of calm when I grew big areas of one type of flower and they all grew up in this like big beautiful mass of flowers together. And I've noticed is the kind of same way that I paint. Like, I find an image, like a type of flower that I really enjoy painting, and it feels so good to just keep painting the same flower over and over, and then I have this kind of room full of the same form. Yeah, it was quite interesting to see the similarities in that.
Yeah, I kept on, I thought it was just like, because, yeah, I don't know, I'm a painter and my mother's a gardener, and she always used to be like, her garden is like her painting, and I'd always be like, yeah, okay. And then as I was doing these interviews, it's like basically every painter kept on bringing up gardening, and like they're often most, yeah, a lot of them were also gardeners themselves, and how, yeah, there's this really beautiful intertwining between that kind of like, yeah, that base layer and putting in the work and the soil, and then it's kind of those, yeah, those flowers or those rewards are kind of might be that surface that you see, but there's all that work and stuff that goes into those base layers.
Yeah, it's kind of always a bit of a surprise at what appears, and it's this bit of like a magic moment when the plants grow and you see what you've grown, and it doesn't always look how you imagine, and it's always like it's a special thing. And the same with painting. Like, I only really know what the painting's going to look like once I've fully finished it, and then it just appears to me. And yeah.
And I wanted to ask a bit about your kind of ritual, your gardening ritual and your painting ritual, and how they intertwine. Do you find yourself in the studio after gardening, or does it all just kind of, depending on the day or...?
I think that I have big periods of time where I'm planning paintings or planning a whole exhibition, and that's when I spend a lot of time outside in nature and in the garden and kind of dreaming up all my ideas, and lots of time just sitting in amongst plants and drawing down little sketches of what my paintings might look like or writing a bit about them. And so yeah, kind of leading up to starting to do the creating painting side, I spend lots of time outside, and then I've kind of formed this big feeling of what I want to create, and then I go into the studio and have like long weeks of painting, and yeah, fluctuates like that. And then after the end of a show, then I usually spend a whole lot more time in the garden again and kind of build new ideas for the next series.
Wonderful. And along with this intertwining of painting and gardening, you have already briefly talked about it, but you also have a writing practice. You said once that your paintings and poetry practice are reciprocally influential to the other, moving from one to the other as they call out. I wanted to ask if, yeah, your writing practice weaved its way into this body of work, and also if there are any other like poetic references or writing or writers that you find yourself looking to when making bodies of work.
Yeah, writing just seems to always come to me whenever I'm thinking up an exhibition and a series of paintings. There's always some words inside me that come out, and they often help me. Once I've written those down, it helps me kind of ground back to the feeling of what I want to create, and to kind of remind myself of what I'm creating. I read over my words and I'm like, oh yes, that's the energy of it. Yeah, and I've always done that. I used to write a lot more poetry, just and kind of submit it to local journals and things like that. And now my writing practice is very much completely connected with my painting practice, and I just really spend most of my time writing in amongst my paintings, and they all kind of connect together. Yeah, I probably spent a lot of time around other, like, Wellington poets and writers when I was at art school, and so being surrounded by painters and writers at the same time was just this whole world of all mixed in together.
Yeah, I feel like everything with the creative practice, everything from your life just kind of all intertwines and weaves and kind of collapses into one kind of beautiful cosmos of, like, influences and stuff. Yeah, and I also wanted to delve into the making process of the paintings themselves. How do you go about approaching the canvas?
Yeah, well, for this series, I have had lots of kind of reference photos that I keep in folders on my phone of all the different flowers and shapes and also all the different colours that I want to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And then I do little sketches in my notebook of kind of ideas of what I want the paintings to look like, and they're really tiny little thumbnail kind of pen and ink sketches. And then from there I kind of choose a canvas size and picture what I feel like would work good on that size canvas, and then spend like quite a long time, like at least an hour, maybe longer, mixing paint colours and trying to find the right colours for one painting. And for the big ones, I have to mix quite a lot of paint because it's so much canvas to cover. So that's quite a meditative process of just, I do lots of test swatches on little bits of canvas, trying to find the right colours and like holding them up in different lights and seeing what feels good. And then when I found the right colours, then I mix big batches of that colour of oil paint. I've just got a glass palette and I mix them on there. And yeah, after I've got the paint colours all sorted, I start painting, and I usually start with the flowers, kind of like a centre top flower. I start painting and it kind of emerges from there, and then paint the leaves and it slowly kind of forms. The whole flower just appears on the canvas, and so I haven't, for these ones I didn't sketch anything out. I just let it happen how it wanted to, and yeah, it's a very special freeing experience because I can only really get a sense of what it's going to be like once I've put like the background colour on, and then it really like shows itself to me. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's this real mix of, yeah, a lot of calm kind of planning and feeling out the painting before you put that paint on the canvas. But then even with that kind of that meditative pre-painting, it's like, yeah, you still never know, and it's not until you put those final layers on that the painting really shows itself to you. And compositionally, the works are quite pared back in nature, the flower or the butterfly being the sole focus and center point of the work, with a mostly monotoned painted background, both the background and the image taking on the same method of treatment. Do you want to speak a little bit to this stylistic approach to the image and the application of paint that you use?
Yeah, I think that I've found this way of painting has kind of just happened over the years, and it's something that gives me a really like sense of calm and just this glowing good feeling when I see a painting that I create in this style. I just know it's like, it's right, and it's like a, I don't know, it's like this special magical feeling that I get. Yeah, and sometimes I try and, say, do more detailed paintings and things, and they create a completely different feeling. So I think I've just ended up painting in this certain way. And it was quite interesting to, when I started painting the butterflies, I noticed that the petals of the flowers, and because they're so big and kind of soft and almost abstract, they are quite similar to butterfly forms.
Mm.
And in painting these smaller butterflies, I made them the same size as the flower petals, like their wings are like the flower petals. And originally had planned to do more detailed butterflies and realized that when I made them quite abstract, they had this the same kind of soft glowing, peaceful quality as the flowers did, and that was quite special. And I hadn't really planned that. It was just experimenting with lots of different ways of painting them. Sorry, there's a chicken just walking.
I know, me. I can hear the chicken. It's quite nice.
Yeah. So a lot of experimenting and then kind of sitting with what feels really good and just following that.
Yeah, they're almost like kind of like, rather than this like perfect representational detailed depiction of the flowers, they kind of capture like a feeling and this kind of dreamlike memory of them that fall into this beautiful abstraction, which I think is really nice because it links with, yeah, your personal time with the flowers and that really lovely like feeling of it.
Yeah, it really is kind of not trying to get the flowers accurate, it's getting the energy and feeling of the flower more.
And lastly, what are your hopes for viewers that engage with this body of work?
I think that I really love when people have different experiences and connections with my paintings, and that reminds people of different things. And I hope to kind of create a space that feels really calm and warm and peaceful for people to be in and around my paintings. I've really enjoyed growing flowers at the community garden and having other people at the gardens experience them, which is so different to a private garden. And it feels very similar to creating an exhibition where you create these things for people to spend time with. And yeah, it's kind of the same. Like, I would love to just grow lots of flowers that people can just come and pick and take home and sit with them. It's kind of the same with my paintings. Like, I really love creating these beautiful things for other people to experience and spend time with. And yeah, so that's my hope. I guess I just want to make good feeling things for people.
That was Brianna Jameson speaking to me about her current exhibition on at Sanderson Contemporary Garden Day, which is on until the 29th of March. So be sure to go check that one out.
Only positive critiques. Honest.
Various artists.
We've now got a song by Wolf Alice. I saw her live at Laneway and absolutely amazing. So this is one of my favorites from her. This is Don't Delete the Kisses. Enjoy.
Thank you. It's the 95 BFM Art Guide on various artists.
It's paintings and that.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tamaki Makaurau, as mentioned on the show, Te Mōrio Te Wai, a solo exhibition by Sky Lunson Story, is on at Window Gallery until the 18th of March.
Also mentioned on the show, Garden Day by Brianna Jameson is on at Sanderson Contemporary until the 29th of March.
Tomorrow at Melanie Roger Gallery is a special one-day exhibition and live event by Matt Elwood, Frieze St. Laurent Drawing Redaction, by which the audience will be invited under set conditions to cut and take away a piece of the artist's drawing for free. That's on from 3 till 5 p.m., so head along.
Yvonne Todd's Diary of a Carrot is on at the Arts House Trust at Par Homestead until the 22nd of March.
Get Ready With Me, a group show by Aria McInnes, Kiani Refa, and Rita Takeuchi, as well as Goldie's Grove, a solo exhibition by Jude Stevens, are on at Room until the 11th of April.
Luke Willis Thompson's B42040 A1A1A is on at Nutukaka Gallery until the 13th of March.
Dreaming From Afar, a group show featuring Brunel Diaz Prims, Gian Manic, and Tyrone Tiwar, is on at Gus Fisher Gallery until the 2nd of May.
Fiona Connor's Blanket Games is on at Coastal Signs until the 14th of March.
Justin Tenney's Engine is on at Treadler until the 13th of March.
And Gordon Bennett and Emily Karaka, After the Undercurrents, is on at Artspace Aotearoa until the 11th of April. If you have something you want on the Arts Guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for us for various artists for today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us today.
Sky Lunson Story.
And Brianna Jameson.
Nei rā, hoki te mihi kia koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95bfm.com or check out our Instagram at 95bfm various artists for more.
Ka hoki mai mātou a Tera Wiki. Next up is The Land of the Good Groove with Mari. My name is Sophia.
And I'm Maya.
That was Various Artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95BFM. Keep it on the B.
Ka kite.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.